Hi, and welcome to Jackie Winter Gives You the Business. I'm Jeremy Wartzman, and I'm here with my co-host, Lara Chan Baker.
Hello.
Hello. Here at Jackie Winter, our roles put us right in the center of the action in between client and creative, so we get to see all sides of the process. Each week, we come together in the evil supervillain lair that is our recording studio and dissect three different links we've come across during our recent internet travels. We use these as a jumping off point to look at what's shaping the issues, processes, happenings, and ideas across the creative industries today. This week, we are going through our open tabs and we'll be discussing what's in our trophy cases, whether AI has been overhyped, and of course, interspecies breeding. Helping us bring some outside perspective today is our very special guest, Dave King. Dave is the CEO and founder of the Melbourne-based creative artificial intelligence startup Move37, where the focus is on developing tools to augment ideation, conceptual creativity, and invention. Our first run-in with Dave was at the award-winning independent creative agency, The Royals, where he was founder and head of innovation. Dave has more than 20 years' experience developing an understanding of consumer behavior, media consumption, emerging platforms, and creative practices, making him the perfect guest for today's show. Dave, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
How are you?
I'm feeling great. It's great to be in the lair, finally see it from the inside.
I've got to admit, when I was writing the intro this week, I couldn't remember if we'd used lair before. And now that you said it, I'm thinking we might have. But hopefully only close listeners would notice, but now I've let the secret out anyway.
It's really hard to come up with them every week.
It's really
hard. I always just kind of look around at what's on my desk.
Yeah. Oh my God. Same. I've used everything that could possibly be generated from the stuff that's on my desk. Dave, I think we should get to the most important thing though, which is that you just got a golden retriever puppy.
We did. Frankie, the golden retriever puppy, who's 15 weeks old, a bundle of fur and literally shedding all over the house, but adorable. So everything's forgivable.
Can't say I'm not mad that Frankie isn't here with us today, but
Frankie's
I'll forgive you.
Frankie's here in spirit.
Jeremy, how are you doing?
I am doing okay.
Same as every week.
Same as every week. It's a really big question. You know, I'm really trying to get into the habit where when people ask me, like, you know, it's like how honest, like, should I be about how, you know, like, am I okay? Maybe I didn't really sleep well last night. I don't know. Like, you know, it's like, I know.
Yeah,
it's
just, do they want to know?
I know it's a friendly thing, but every time, like, I hear it, like, I do try to kind of take it seriously. That's why I always kind of pause it and I try to kind of think about it.
And then you just say, okay.
And then
anyway.
I just say I'm okay anyway.
Predictable. Let's get into it.
But I am okay. Yes, Laura, let's get into it indeed. What do you have for us this week?
All right. I have got three short links from Gabberish this week.
Which three? Don't you always tell me off for bringing more than one link?
Yes, I do tell you off for bringing more than one link, but I brought more than one link because I want to talk about the general theme, not necessarily about each of the links.
Okay.
You
have feelings.
There's method to my madness. Anyway, Gabberish is a fabulous online publication that was launched some time ago by Siobhan Fitzgerald, and it's co-edited by our wonderful friend Jess Lilly, who was also on the show a couple of seasons ago. And for those of you who haven't come across it before, it's basically a bit of an outlet for the kind of pleasures and frustrations of working in advertising. As they put it, creative therapy for creative minds, and it's really great. Anyway, each issue they have a theme, and I want to throw all the way back today to their third issue, which was all about awards. And now I personally have been out of an ad agency for quite some time now, working here at Jackie Winter, but I definitely still know the kind of weird mix of joy and jealousy that awards can spark amongst agency folk and kind of hold creative teams captive in some ways. And, you know, many a think piece and many a vent on Twitter have covered this topic before, and I thought it was high time that we take it for a spin ourselves. It's undeniable. Awards are a big deal in the ad industry. Agencies kind of proudly display their hall of Cannes Lions, Clio's, Effie's, DAD pencils, you know, all along their reception desks and things. And
what's the one agency that has a dumpster in the reception and they put all the awards in there? Do you know them? I think it was TBWA who did it.
I've seen it and now I can't think.
I'll find it. Go on.
All the offices blend into one after a while. And, you know, Campaign Brief, so our sort of primary industry publication, is, you know, pretty awash with kind of fiery commentary about who deserved or didn't deserve to win what. And really, I mean, winning awards can mean winning a big job or client. And despite how much everyone seems to hate having to enter them, everyone loves winning them. And I've picked these three links, as I said, not so much to talk about anything specific in them, but really just to act as kind of an anchor for this discussion. And to give us a starting point, I want to read from the first link, which was Max McKeon's intro to the issue. And he writes, "Every industry has awards. We in advertising like to compare ourselves to the more illustrious ones, like film, wine, and journalism. But there are others, real estate agents, under-8s badminton, and yes, even commercial building foundations. We love our work, and it's great to have the best of it collected, curated, and collated neatly together in one place, where we can all see what the industry's biggest names admire. It helps us reset a little knowing that somewhere out there, some lucky bastard is having their hard work translate into something pure. It's inspiring to see creativity and even more inspiring to see that it can actually make it out into the real world. But maybe, just maybe, there is too much of an onus on the shiny faux precious metal. The best creatives I've ever worked with have not always been the most awarded. There's been a rough correlation, but far from a perfect one. Awards are a cheat sheet used by the industry to gauge creative worth. It's a filter that says a creative and their work comes prejudged by others and that maybe that evaluation is enough, but that feels lazy. Any ECD worth his or her mustard and worth working for should be able to tell great work and great potential, even if it was never made into a case study or if it's just spec work in a student portfolio. After all, that's their job. So the second link I chose today was an anonymous survey of the unawarded to get a bit of a sense of how it feels to work in an industry that values so significantly something that you've never received. And here's just a couple of quotes that stood out to me from a copywriter. Awards make me feel stressed. I feel pressure to win them, even though I know it's not a real measure of the work, whether it was effective, smart, creative, or original. I also feel pressure to win them to advance my career. However, winning doesn't seem to make a huge difference. Not winning seems to matter more. From a senior art director. I feel like success is constantly out of reach. It's a constant stretch, and at times it drives me with a relentless madness. In other moments, there's the delivery of satisfaction. Mostly, it's a need to strive for something greater than what exists. And lastly, from a creative director, no other industry feels the need to pat themselves on the back as much as we do. Creatives feel the need to temper eating clients' shit with endless peer recognition. So a mix of feedback there. And as expected, yeah, there is a bit of a blend between motivation and frustration. And then, of course, there's, you know, the ongoing issue with work that's created only to win awards, which I don't know, I always feel kind of goes against the whole point of advertising in the first place, in that it's meant to achieve a business goal for a client. But anyway, for the third link, a short piece by Raphael Alicia, which I thought was great, but also a bit tricky. So again, to read a small section from early on in the piece, he writes, essentially, an award is a recognition of your talents by your peers. It says, well done, we like this, we think it's better than all this other stuff. And on the surface, that seems like a fair reward for your efforts. It's something positive, something both encouraging and elevating, but there is also something deeper at play, something more destructive. Validation. When we experience joy from receiving an award, we are effectively basing our sense of adequacy or worth on the validation of others. We are giving someone else the power to decide what is worthy and what is not. And in doing so, we inadvertently place greater weight on the opinions of a select few rather than the one that matters most, our own. Now, the piece is, it's multifaceted and it says a lot more than what I just read. It's worth a full read and makes a lot of great points about the kind of impact of awards on self-worth and esteem. But the issue with this particular section for me is that I think advertising is inherently meant to be judged by others. After all, its worth is in how it can reach people because it's advertising. It's meant to influence and be interpreted by others. So in that sense, it being judged and evaluated by other people than yourself seems quite understandable and okay to me. But what I'm not so sure of is the level of importance or the level of fairness in the actual process of judging that surrounds advertising awards. And Raphael is right in that letting awards guide your work can definitely be a bad path. So Dave, with you joining us on the show not long after your kind of semi-departure from Adland and before we launch kind of full throttle into your newest venture, I'm really keen to hear from you what your experience with this kind of award circus has been over the years and whether that actually continues in any way now that you've transitioned into this new space. So I guess we'll start with how do you feel about awards in general?
Yeah, I've never been a huge fan. I think the point you make or the article makes about acquiring validation through that technique of being awarded something is really tricky and really dangerous to navigate if you're a creative. My background is more coming from sort of in the 90s and 2000s, like product development and working on making experiences for consumers and customers and things like that. So I guess that form of validation came from, you know, does it work? Are people using it? And, you know, in at the Royals, I think the most satisfying moments for me have been where consumers have really embraced the work. They've used it, they've shared it, they've talked about it. That said, I've loved it when we've sort of hit mainstream press. We're in the front of The Age or the SMH or Al Jazeera. Our work's been featured on that. And that's more, I guess, that's a little bit ego-driven perhaps that, you know,
I like to see.
Yeah,
good to be celebrated.
Yeah, totally. So that's a form of that. But I agree with some of the points you made. The awards process can be a bit contrived and I do think it rewards the agencies that have deep pockets to create a lot of case studies. I mean, some agencies have departments just making case studies for awards and the smaller agencies or most agencies can't compete with that. So it can be a numbers game, the number of entries you go in, the number of sort of case studies you can possibly produce in video form are a constraint for some better work.
Absolutely. So for anyone listening who doesn't work in advertising or is sort of adjacent to that, to enter these awards, you do have to put together these really pretty detailed case studies. And the ones that you see winning are always these ones with these like amazing sort of video pieces outlining like what they did, how they did it, what the impact was. And it takes not only a lot of time, but a lot of money as well.
That's just internally, though. The cost for entering.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, that's the thing. Like, you know, awards are kind of this subculture in itself that almost like seems to be a kind of a relic of what the industry was, you know, this kind of period, kind of, I don't know, like, yeah, like in the 90s and everything, especially, you know, you look at what happens in Cannes and, you know, this whole kind of, this whole little, I don't know, just subculture kind of around it. But it really is, I guess the illustration equivalent is kind of like source books and those workbooks, you know, where you'd have to pay thousands of dollars just to get a page in them. And then they would kind of go around. Then those workbooks, and similar to these awards, they become industries in themselves. And, you know, it's like the business model is not really kind of sustainable. But at the same time, it seems like people are still entering them. They're still kind of giving these awards away.
Yes, exactly. I really want to talk to you about illustration awards in a moment. But first, I want to ask, I mean, Dave, like, do you think that there are positive side effects of agencies being kind of so motivated by awards?
I think the degree of motivation is certainly worth watching out for, but I do think that they can attract clients, like you mentioned. They can attract staff, and that's not necessarily a negative thing. I think they can reflect ambition, and people want sort of curious, hardworking, interested, ambitious people, both as clients and staff. And when awards are at their best, they reflect those personalities and those attributes. So I think it's more when they become the sole goal of you know, the work, rather than how effective it is. Has it transformed the business? Has it helped the business pivot into a different realm or launch something? If it's just the craft or the way it looked or the pun, I think that's when it gets in the way.
What about when hiring? Do you think about awards when you're hiring creatives?
I think we think about portfolios. So we definitely look at the work, and one representation of how well received any folio, a bit of work in the folio is through awards. So for instance, we've just hired at the Royals a super senior creative from South Africa, and we wouldn't have been really that familiar with a lot of the work, but it's been well awarded. So I think it's a signal. It's one of many signals. I think when hiring people, there's nothing better than to talk to people they've worked with. That's a much better sort of sign rather than just awards. But yeah, they all add up to a picture.
Did you actually enter any awards? And like, was that part of the culture of the Royals in any way?
The Royals enter awards. Yeah. Not. I think we're quite circumspect about it. I think the partners, they wouldn't mind me saying this, have debated this a lot about whether the entry fees, as you mentioned, are worth it because it is a huge business. If you look at the number of entries, the number of categories, say for the Cannes line, they just keep adding categories. It's a great business model. So I've said before, maybe we start our own awards. Maybe that's better than being an agency.
Make more money there.
Or maybe we start
awards. I'll join
you. Yeah, totally. Start awards for awards and just award different awards for awards. It got a bit meta, so I stopped that train of thought. But no, the Royals are involved. There are some agencies taking a stand and going, no, we refuse anymore to enter them, which is a new type of positioning. But no, I think the partners at the Royals and most of the staff at the Royals would believe that, you know, good work should be submitted and people like to celebrate if they win something.
Mm. I think about, like, back in the day, I was a junior at MNC, and I remember at one point I had given the task of putting together just a calendar of all the awards and what the entry due dates were like and the prize and stuff. And I couldn't believe the sheer number of awards that were, you know.
Totally. And
it's just crazy. And sometimes, like, this is not what we were doing. I'm not saying that's what they were doing, but I've heard from, like, other friends at other agencies where they just you know, all through the year being forced to, like, fire off entries for every single thing possible, left, right and center, the good awards, the bad awards, whatever it is, just to, like, it's like you're throwing it all at the wall, see what sticks, you know? And I don't know if that's the best method.
Well, you certainly, and you also get contacted by people all over the world and say, we've got these London, these Berlin, these Calgary, these Paris, these Hong Kong awards, and you kind of go, whoa, okay, you can't enter them all. So it's quite competitive on that front as well.
Incredibly competitive. So actually, on that note, Jeremy, I want to talk to you about being sort of contacted, because we get a lot of, we and our artists get contacted a lot for sort of illustration awards, but also these illustration kind of source books and stuff, like you were saying. And I think these pieces that we're talking about today are specifically about advertising, which we're often separated from the awards a bit, despite the fact that we're often pretty involved in a lot of the work. And I want to hear about illustration awards, because it's kind of a whole other kettle of fish. And there's some confusion sometimes, I think, around illustration awards, which ones actually have real merit, which ones are kind of just money grabs, which ones are just sort of taking advantage of artists, which ones are actually going to be useful for your career. And I want to hear from you. Do you think there are any that are worth looking at, and how can an artist tell the difference?
Well, yeah, it's a really good question. I don't know. I do think we have to separate out the kind of source book promotional thing from this conversation, because that is a very kind of different thing, and it's a lot kind of thornier. I mean, there really aren't that many – There aren't that many illustration awards at the moment. I mean, the AOI has done their World Illustration Awards, which I think has been a great initiative in terms of not making it a local thing and making it kind of this worldwide thing, because I think what I'm kind of seeing more of is trends for awards in general to be getting a lot more kind of focused. So, you know, you have a lot of kind of smaller awards that are kind of coming up.
There's a Society of Illustrators as well. That's quite a big one.
Yes, exactly. This is a real tricky one because, yeah, I want to kind of, I think there's a whole social element of it that can't be denied as well. So this whole world aspect of it and the local aspect, like the Society of Illustrators is an amazing organization, but it's a very New York kind of centric thing as well. And I think there's similarities to kind of Con as well, like in terms of keeping up this kind of annual tradition that almost like it's almost just kind of keeping up a marker of kind of who's actually kind of working and who's kind of still relevant. And I think especially for the advertising awards, it's kind of, it is effective for people who are in a really like that kind of top echelon of kind of production companies especially. And I do kind of see that kind of merit there. For individual practitioners though, I really think it's all about kind of the recognition aspect that you kind of say. Mm. And I kind of think that the model of how people are kind of finding work and using awards as a promotional tool, I don't think is as relevant to illustrators or individual practitioners in the same way. However, the barrier of entry is so much lower that it can't hurt. Like, you know, I think you as an illustrator could enter every single award in the world, like, you know, maybe like between 9 or 10 different awards programs every year and not even touch what it would cost to make one kind of Con entry.
Yes, basically. Completely.
Obviously, the scales are different in terms of individual versus company, but I think it's absolutely essential. So, I mean,
well, we look at the recaps from various sort of key award shows and we'll often look to see like, is there anyone interesting in there? What are they kind of doing? What are people, like we use it as a resource as agents, you know, to see if there are any interesting kind of original new artists that we want to explore. So it's definitely, I mean, and I don't imagine we'd be the only agents looking at it or the only, I'm sure there are art buyers and clients and, you know, editorial commissioners and whoever else looking at this stuff.
Yeah, a big part of a big benefit of the awards for individuals is really more about the judges and who are the judges and who's kind of getting on board. And that's the whole reason that I love judging awards as well, is I like to kind of see that talent. It's a real kind of fun process for me, especially. So yeah, I think it's definitely kind of a worthwhile thing. And I think, but there it's also interesting to see what has kind of replaced the awards as well, like in terms of these annual kind of roundups that we talk a lot about.
Yes.
So when the New York Times kind of does their roundup.
Year in illustration.
Or like even like, and I think it's the same thing in advertising as well. Like I love when Ad Age comes out with their kind of recaps of kind of the end of the year. It's like that for me fills the gap that awards kind of, you know, do feel in kind of that way. I think it's interesting that we talk about, yeah, how do you kind of measure what the awards are kind of being based on as well? Because that brings up the whole culture of kind of scam ads as well and kind of people who are creating ads that aren't designed to be run, but they're just kind of celebrating a really funny idea. And most of those, like you talk about illustration, scam ads are rife with illustration because but that's the funny thing because it's stuff that clients would never buy, but it's so good creatively.
It's stuff like they should buy.
It's all about the wit and the idea, which is amazing. It's stuff they should buy.
Yeah, so there's a lot of, I mean, look, we don't have time to get into the whole scam thing right now, but it's funny because you often hear the argument and that like how frustrated people are by people entering awards with scam work. But there is really that side as well of like, well, what other opportunity do we have to be awarded for these ideas that are actually really good that no client's ever going to go for because they might be a bit risky, which is a really fair point.
Before we wrap up, Dave, I'm just kind of curious, like with the new venture that you're working in at the moment, like how are you thinking about kind of recognition and kind of marketing kind of in that way? Because yeah, awards had been the easiest kind of thing to do, but now that they're not as relevant, where's your head at in terms of what you're going to look for?
Yeah, it's not a big part of what we're doing. Thinking about that question coming in today, I really think that sort of recognition or acknowledgement in what we're doing on the technical side is a technical achievement, is like getting a successful prediction or a successful recommendation or the AI, you know, working a little bit better. And then if you go really nerdy, I guess the data scientists like getting sort of conference papers accepted and to present to their peers at big conferences and things like that, which is another level of recognition. But I think at the end of the day, when you're making a product or a platform, it's really adoption and feedback of that. And that's,
and potential press from that, I imagine then.
No, that's true. I still believe in PR and like you, I like the roundups. I like the Ad Age and Fast Company, kind of Fast Company talking about the top 100 most innovative companies in the world. It'd be great to feature there, that kind of thing. And part of that is being able to, you know, attract staff and meet new partners and that kind of thing, as well as, you know, recognition.
And one day the AI overlords will just give us the awards naturally themselves, hopefully, if all goes according to plan. Laura, thanks very much for bringing the link to our attention, and we'll move on from there. My My link for the week comes from the blog The Ad Contrarian, which is probably one of the last remaining people writing on the Blogger platform.
Yeah, probably.
I see that kind of orange bee and it's like, whoa, it takes me back. But I kind of like it. It's kind of a bit, you know, retro fresh at the moment.
And it fits the content.
It does. It does. The site is run by Bob Hoffman. He's an ad agency veteran and author. And I think we've covered a post of his once before at this stage. I don't remember exactly
when. We were
going
to, and I decided not to because... We'll talk about it.
Okay, we'll talk about it. Well, look, the post came up around the time that the Super Bowl was on last month, and the title of it is AI and BS. And as I knew we were going to have Dave on the podcast this season, I kind of really had to save it for some discussion here. So that's what I've done. So the piece, which is relatively short, it's a reflection on the recent advertising messages revolving around AI, in particular two Super Bowl ads from IBM and Microsoft. Now, Bob is definitely a bit of a cynic, to say the least. I mean, he's very traditional. You know, he's wrote a few great books on advertising, none of which I've read. But, you know, he's definitely kind of an older school. But I really like how he kind of writes about advertising. You know, he's definitely a cynic in ways regarding intersection of technology and advertising. I think he's someone who kind of, you know, obviously started in the more kind of traditional media buying landscape and has seen that kind of change to programmatic advertising.
I mean,
and
it's a bit like get off my lawn kind of vibes.
It is, but he hasn't, but that's what I like.
I'm not discounting it.
I like it that he's got some solid points though.
But he's someone you can relate to, Jerry.
He really is. So I'll give you a touch of what he says. He says, and I quote here, AI is now in the same fantasy phase that online advertising was in 20 years ago. We are being bombarded with horseshit about how AI has made everything so wonderful and in the future is going to make everything even wonderfuler, like that phrase. He goes on to draw parallels between the ad industry's embrace of previous things like when interactive or programmatic advertising was similarly fawned over and how in many ways that's left us in this huge mess at the moment with everything from fake news, fraud, election tampering, etc., all those light subjects. And again, and he warns that same wide-eyed stampede into AI could be a lot more costly. And now this also comes at a time where we've also seen recent calls from people like Elon Musk, for example, calling AI our biggest existential threat, as well as more sage warnings from minds such as Stephen Hawking, who says AI could spell the end of the human race.
Woohoo!
Very light reading indeed. So look, it's a short piece. I pretty much summed it up here, but Bob closes with a request and he says, I quote here, "Of course, the simple-minded marketing industry armed with its usual obsessions and delusions can't see anything in AI but one, another miracle to promote, two, a topic for dreadful gee whiz quote unquote content, and three, a great new jargon term to insert into every sentence. This time around, can we please be a little more mature and thoughtful?" Now, I think that for many of us in marketing advertising, especially on the creative side, we might not actually realize how deep AI research has come and where it can actually go. I know we kind of think about chatbots and targeted ads, but I think kind of in many ways, we're only starting to realizing that the genie is kind of out of the bottle. And it's definitely something that I know for me personally makes me kind of slightly uneasy, but mostly that's kind of out of ignorance. It's because I just don't know really much about it. It feels like something that's happening, but we only are kind of seeing kind of what's on the surface. For example, a contender for the link this week is all about how Google and Facebook keep voodoo dolls of every user. Have you guys heard about this at all?
You sent me the link. Yeah.
Oh, it's mental. So basically, I mean, I don't even kind of fully understand it, but it's basically a virtual copy of your internet presence so it can predict what you're going to do and when you're going to do it and kind of serve you appropriate ads and content depending on how this doll reacts. So I know, like for myself, remember we were talking about like the, I was talking about my mustache on the podcast and yes. Someone was saying that I looked like Gandhi. And then all of a sudden in my Instagram feed, I got like an ad for kind of, you know, for Gandhi's biography. So this kind of explains this phenomenon in a few ways. Look, unlike previous links we've had on the show, I don't really have too much to add here, but I'm really looking to be educated a bit more because I think a lot of our listeners are interested in this subject as well. So Dave, as someone who has a really rich history in media, tech, and marketing, most recently having left the ad world, you co-founded to focus on your AI-focused business. I'm really curious to hear your thoughts on this. And I guess firstly, can you perhaps just tell us a bit more about what you're kind of currently doing in the space with your business?
Sure. So at Move37, our ambition is to create tools that help unlock people's ideas. So in that sense, it's quite different from a lot of the AI that you see in the marketing and advertising landscape, and I'll touch on that in a second. We want to augment creativity, and we think that, you know, having a bit of software, because essentially that's what it is. Algorithms aren't new, software is not new, some of the labels are new, but when you drill down, it's data science and it's data and it's software and it's interface, that's what it is. And so we want to create tools that help marketers express themselves better. We want to help them put their best foot forward, express their brand, give them thought starters, you know, potentially write the thing with them, but not for them, and potentially even sort of create better briefs if they're going to have something produced. We don't have any ambition or capability to produce the next award-winning video. It's more about, you know, what should you do? with all the options out there, especially with, you know, MarTech and digital marketing opportunities, there's a lot of paralysis by analysis. Marketers are kind of stuck going, where do I turn to for advice? So part of what we want to do is create a platform that helps them, like I say, put their brand's best foot forward. And I guess some of the stuff that Bob's referring to in that article about the programmatic side has been taken a bit far, in the sense that programmatic advertising seems to work like, through A/B testing, we're just going to put enough messages out there until it gets a click. And you basically end up optimizing until one user clicks it, and then you go, great, I've done it, and that's it. But it does nothing for growing the brand or reputation. There's nothing, there's no social currency. There's nothing to talk about at the dinner table. There's no ideas being transferred around society. It's a very lonely practice. So part of our ambition, and me having seen some of that, the Royals aren't you know, that focused on that side of things either, is to bring it back a bit to the center and say, you're a brand, you've got an audience you'd like to communicate with. You need to say some things, and we're going to help you work out what to say and what to do and some tactics. The audience has, you know, needs and desires and you know, wants to buy things and wants to hear things and wants to read things. So how can we matchmake and bring you into the middle without putting too much emphasis on either end, if that makes sense?
And I have to go into the name as well, because it's one of my favorite things about the business. Can you just kind of explain the genesis for our listeners?
Sure. So there was a famous moment in, I guess, the AI mythology a couple of years ago, where in the game of Go, which is an ancient Chinese game, very complex, it's a board game that's hotly contested in lots of places in Asia, Europe, and other places around the world. The world champion, Lee Sedol, who's basically a rock star in his country, was challenged to a game by Google Brain. So they had a machine, and they said, we think our machine's good enough to play the world champion, and they'd had some success. So they had this, I guess, match event. It reminds me of, like, you know, Billie Jean King kind of tennis match event, which was one of the most highly watched live streamed and broadcast events in South Korean history. It's a 7-game series, I think. I can't remember exactly. But in the first game, Lee Sedol won in a canter. The second game, Lee Sedol won. And the third game, everything was going fine until move 37. So what happened in move 37 was, and again, this is a bit of hyperbole, historically, it said the machine created the move that had never been taught, which is roughly true, because the model of AlphaGo, which is the name of the computer, was to learn about the game, not be taught every individual move. So it learned the rules, and then it kind of learned by iteration, by playing, you know, thousands, if not millions of games. It learned how to perfect, you know, its game. So it played this move, and it was move 37. Lee Sedol stood there, stared at the board, and then got up and walked out, had a bit of a moment. And the commentators at first were saying, well, that's a crazy move. The computer doesn't know what it's doing. And then they kind of paused and then said, on the other hand, hang on. Yeah. And then everyone was like blown away. And as history shows, AlphaGo went on to win the series and defeat Lee Sedol, which is an interesting moment if you think about the light and dark of that. And there's a great Netflix show, a movie about this, documentary about this. I think it's called AlphaGo.
Excellent.
And it's really bringing up some of these issues around what is the role of AI in our lives, and, you know, what can it do? What should we trust it to do? Those kind of aspects, which are for all of us to think about.
That story in particular is a very us versus them kind of narrative, which is often part of the theme of the narrative when we're talking about AI.
Yeah.
Well, it depends where you look. Some media is very us versus them. Other media is completely like, you know, we are one. And it's a really, really depends where you look, but it's interesting to look at it from both those angles.
Well, there's a second part of that story, in that years before that, Garry Kasparov, the world champion of chess, had been beaten by an IBM computer called Deep Blue. And rather than throw the toys out of the cot, he found that really interesting. He's an incredible guy, and said he's going to create a new form of chess called Centaur chess. And Centaur chess is man and machine versus man and machine, or person and machine versus person and machine. The theory being that no person can beat a machine, but no machine can beat a person and a machine. And that's really inspiring. So how can we work together? How can we augment our own, you know, the benefits that human and machine bring to the party?
Yeah,
well, tell us a bit more about your personal feelings, like, especially on the current atmosphere around AI. I mean, are these concerns, like the ones that Bob is bringing up, are they warranted? I mean, if so, are you doing anything to mitigate them? And or if not, like, why? Because there's definitely there's some deep shit in here.
Yeah, I think, look, firstly, the stuff that Bob's talking about is very Adland focused.
Yeah.
And I'm less worried about that. So I think he's right.
But doesn't that, sorry to interrupt, Dave, but doesn't the stuff kind of in Adland, doesn't it really kind of bleed into kind of, like, you know, if you look at kind of Google and Facebook, who moderate kind of most of our, you know, online life. You know, it's their ad businesses that are kind of the thing that kind of that drives
sure.
them. Sure.
No, way. I definitely think those things are worth looking at. I think I'm less worried about Adland using AI as a cliche in their hyping things up. So there've been some examples of, you know, a Japanese agency creating an AI creative director, which is a stunt.
Oh yes, we talked about that yeah. at some point, I think.
And that's what people think of AI and creative. They go, yeah, remember that? Or Alexis ad that's been written by AI and those kind of things. And they're basically production hacks. They're not really too disturbing or too, you know, they're not leading to some kind of dark dystopia. Mm. I do think that what you mentioned then, Jeremy, is the stuff that we should be looking at is what are the algorithms that we use every day? How are they governing our behavior and our consumption? I mean, I heard the other day that 99% of YouTube content stems from the right-hand side. So not something that someone initially looked at or sought out or clicked on. It's actually what they've been recommended. And I talk to my kids about this. It's like, you know, these recommendations are coming up regardless of your own intent or your own preferences. Someone's steering you. Be aware of that. So those are the things to worry about. I think in general AI, we need data literacy about this stuff. So we all need to. The genie is out of the bottle, just like some people go, maybe the internet would have been better if we hadn't have gone there. Mm. When you look at, you know, Trump and collusion and Cambridge Analytica and those kind of things, you go, imagine a quieter time or just dial-up access or something.
Which is a fun topic for a podcast, but yeah. It's not realistic. Yeah.
No, you can't put the genie back in the bottle. So I think there are immediate social concerns and you need Stephen Hawking and the Elon Musk kind of putting those big statements out there, as well as a lot of people working in the middle trying to work them out. And the things that are worrying, there's no algorithm or data model that's not made by a person. So look behind the scenes, look behind the curtain. You know, unfortunately, at the moment, a lot of those are young white men in Silicon Valley, which is a tiny, narrow sort of, you know, representation of people's opinions. So when data is consumed and digested and labeled, whoever's doing that job brings bias. And if you're not getting gender representation and ethnicity representation in that labeling right at the bottom part of it, that's a real concern because it's going to make recommendations up the funnel about all of what we do. And I don't want to be, you know, my life governed by some Silicon Valley bros who just, you know, tell me that I should, you know. Behave like this or behave like that.
It probably already is mostly, yeah, I think, for most of us. Yeah.
Are you able to mitigate that at all with the new business at all? Like, does that kind of inform your hiring kind of philosophy?
It does. It informs our hiring philosophy. It also informs, you know, we talk about our principles and what matters to us, as well as being aware of the data sets that we're using. Where do they come from? What's their origin story? Mm-hmm. And that transparency, and also how we build our products. So we need to show people, which is a big topic at the moment, when we're making a recommendation, we think you should do this. On what basis are we making that recommendation? People need to understand that. And it's tricky because in interface, you can't explain the depth of that, but you need to give them a hint. Mm. And just like in Facebook, you can go in and say, why am I being targeted this ad? And you can see that.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I think, you know, if you look at a lot of other kind of industries, like especially kind of like food, clothing manufacturer, it's all about that origin. You're like, where did it come from? And I kind of think the more people are empowered, like that whole idea of data origination is something I've never considered. So that's a really interesting point.
It's a data providence story.
Amazing.
I'm owning that.
Laura, I know neither of us really kind of works hands-on in tech, but you've always had some really interesting opinions on how developments like this can affect our little corner of the creative industry. Is there any kind of impact you think AI could have on commercial artists or the illustration industry?
Look, I think I've spoken at length on artificial intelligence on this show several times, and with that sort of question in mind in particular on how it affects our sort of small area of the industry. So I won't add too much here today, but I just have to say, like, I found the piece a little bit annoying, to be honest. I don't think, I mean, look, Bob had a lot to say about people minimizing the potential negative effects of AI, and I really don't think anyone is minimizing it. In fact, it's probably quite the opposite. I think there's a pretty good balance between the deeply negative and the overly positive in the media surrounding AI, perhaps even leaning towards the negative. But as I said before, it all depends where you look. Honestly, I think it's just kind of like any other major development, though, isn't it? Like, if you think about smartphones, the internet, factory robotics, petrol, alcohol, whatever it is, as you said, the genie's out of the bottle. All of these things have had enormous impacts on our ways of life, our economies, our infrastructures, both good and bad. And all of those improvements and concerns have been and are valid. And I think AI is much the same. I think it's an inevitable and exciting and promising and dangerous and harmful and helpful evolution that we're going to face regardless.
I think one of the differences between those other industries, which is true, some of those were a big deal when they first came out or they first evolved, is that one of the concerns about AI and the relating industries is the concentration of data ownership around literally 1, 2, 3 companies, not 100 companies, not 1,000 companies, just a tiny microscopic amount of companies who own a massive representation of the data. And so,
and that's a very real thing to be worried about.
It's a really worrying.
It's a hugely concerning thing.
It's changing
thing.
Our behavior. Well, every time we do a Google search, you know, we're feeding,
You see all these articles, people write these kind of personal pieces where they have tried to, like, extract those, the big five, like from their life. And it's insanely hard. I read a really good one recently that I'll try and find the link to
Taylor
for the show
Lorenz.
Notes. Is it this one?
Yes.
Because there are ones where people have done it, but they haven't done it properly. This person was doing it like
thoroughly.
Where they didn't use anything that was hosted by like Amazon Web Services, whatever. It's so, and it's impossible. Like it's, don't we use Amazon Web Services? I don't know.
Everything.
So yeah.
Taylor Lorenz is a great writer. She did a series of them.
It's
She's
so
probably the
good.
Ones referring
yes.
to.
Yes, that
and she,
is.
And she tried to extract all the Google services from her phone and had things like, obviously she couldn't use maps, but things like some apps were served up images that were hosted on Google and all apps and websites do that.
Yep.
So all of a sudden there's all these apps.
Yeah, she went back to the dark ages. It's crazy.
Yeah,
I think, you know, there's this one line in the piece where Bob says, "The current mania for AI and its relentless promotion as our fabulous future ignores an enormous potential for mischief and danger." And I guess what I want to say is that, like, I think some people, yes, are being too careless, but there is also an intense, widespread and likely, you know, very appropriate level of caution as well amongst governments, scientists, engineers, companies, individuals of all sorts when it comes to this stuff. And I mean, all of that said, I am never one to abstain from chastising our industry for kind of leaping dumbly into the abyss when anyone announces new tech. But that's certainly, I don't think that's the case for all or even many of those exploring the possibilities here. I think the simple truth, perhaps not so simple, but is that whether or not AI poses a threat to human existence, there is no stopping its rise. Like the leaps forward in quantum computing will make these shifts inevitable anyway. And as humans, we have always fixated upon improving life across every facet, right? Kind of regardless of what that might do, you know, on its way. And our use of technology has become our vehicle for doing exactly that. And I think the tracks are already laid for a pretty significant upheaval, I believe. And I understand the fears. I share the fears and I'm cautious and I'm scared, but I'm also excited and I like desperately want to be involved because like what other choice is there?
Oh, welcoming our new robot overlords. But I mean, but seriously, it's also about educating ourselves in terms of where and how our data is being collected.
Yes.
I mean, one thing I found amazingly fascinating, but also a bit weird is that, you know, we were talking to someone at Apple about, you know, how the pencil works on the iPad Pros and how it actually, you don't see it happening, but the iPad's actually predicting where you're kind of going to go. Like it knows what you're going to draw before you draw it. And like, that's amazing for artists, like to be able to kind of, you know, have this kind of like to get that latency kind of so low and almost kind of predictive. But then what does that mean for like, can it actually model what you can do as kind of a drawing in that way? Because we're always thinking about, say, well, illustration and drawing and art is safe. And we'll talk about this in our kind of final link.
Well,
but yeah,
yeah,
it's
amazing
quote about that, which is we shape our tools and then our tools shape us.
Very true. I love that.
It's super true. But also like, I think it's that same, it's a lifelong question, which is obviously hugely concentrated now in this kind of current era of like very, very rapid sort of technical evolution. But it's that same question of like, what do the balance between conveniences and, you know, sort of harm that something sort of does to us, and what makes us human? What is our humanity? What are we taking away each time we kind of develop something else? And we've always had to battle those questions. We are definitely battling them in a bigger way than we've ever probably ever had to before, but it's still that same kind of question.
I think it's an interesting point. So I've heard sort of deep practitioners who have been doing this for a long time sort of talk about how artificial intelligence has really forced us to define what intelligence was in the first place, because we never knew. And when you talk about creative AI, we've had to do the same thing with creativity. So computational creativity has been around for a couple of decades, and I've heard these people talk, and they've been trying to inspect this problem for a long time. And the basic premise is there's no definition of creativity, but it challenges you to question your own humanity and identity and where the boundaries are, so that you know which things we need to protect, like you say. But before there was an artificial version of it, or at least an artificial version that was promised of it, no one
you don't
had
think
to
about
think
it
about that.
Absolutely. And I just look to close, I think, in terms of how it'll affect our industry, back to that original question, all I can say is that we will absolutely not have jobs. Producers will be out.
Speak for yourself. I'm totally going to crank it, put my brain in a jar and just kind of
I'm surprised you haven't already.
Anyway, thank you very much for your perspectives. There are some really interesting points to cover. We've got some links there. We'll pop up in the show notes and move on from there. Our final link from the week, as we do every week, comes from our special guest. And Dave, something I like to ask people is kind of where they get their links from. You're obviously a very kind of plugged in person. You've done our open tabs before as well, our IRL open tabs. You know, I'm sure a lot of stuff kind of gets sent to you, but yeah, are you kind of, do you go about kind of seeking things, or do things kind of come to you? What's your internet hygiene like?
I think being on the internet, you know, as long as you, since, you know, early 90s, there have always been mechanisms to find and discover things. That's one of the great things about the internet, because there's stuff out there. There's always needed to be a layer or apps or software or whatever to help you discover stuff. I think for me these days, in a post RSS world, it's mainly
speak
Twitter.
For yourself. Yeah, like I'm rocking yourself. Our feeds over here.
Yeah, RSS.
It's funny. I think there are a lot of RSS advocates out there, and I think we're actually looking at that tech for understanding and digesting content and topics and things like that. So I don't mean, I think when Google Reader went away, people kind of thought, well, I'm going to have to find otherwise.
Rest in peace. Yes.
Because people had curated their links and built folders, and there's a lot of personal curation.
Huge. It's still a really sore spot for some of us. We could just be mindful. Yeah.
But I think, for me, it's mainly Twitter and newsletters. I think the resurgence of newsletters, very, very niche newsletters, are fantastic. So opt-in, very niche newsletters, Substack, things like that where you can...
So with you.
Yeah, so Substack's great because, you can write a super niche thing and then charge people $1 a month or whatever for it. And if you find your audience, it's Journalism Revisited. But yeah, from a consumption point of view, newsletters and Twitter probably.
Awesome. And take us through this mind-bending link that you've put for us.
So this is super interesting. And I think one of the things we were talking about earlier about AI, part of it I talk to people is get in and have a play, because partly you educate yourself about, what's going on, and you get to sort of digest things and understand the kind of tech that's out there. And this is an example of, it's called GANbreeder. The URL is ganbreeder.app. And this is something, a GAN is a type of neural network. It's a general adversarial network, but that doesn't really matter. The main point is that this is able to generate images. The interesting part of this is if you look at a very good version of a GAN-generated image, you would think it's just a stock photo of a house or a building or a cheeseburger or whatever. But the reality is the model has been trained on thousands, if not millions, of versions of that, and is now able to produce a picture of a cheeseburger or a goat or a house or a Toyota Corolla on demand.
Mm.
So that's what a GAN can do. And this is fairly recent. The degree to which it can do this and the high resolution is fairly recent, like late last year. And NVIDIA put out a paper and a demo of faces that kind of shocked people about how...
person does not exist.
Yeah, this person does not exist was the wrap-up of it. And now there's all sorts of other URLs like this story does not exist that explore these kind of things. So GANbreeder takes it one step further and like the name implies, says, okay, you can generate a table and you can generate an Apple Watch and then you can breed them. And the breeding analogy is really... There's an interface.
Creepy?
Really creepy. Well, it's like breeding Pokemon. You can kind of put them in and see what happens. That wasn't meant to be a sexual education class. but you can dial up and dial down the genes. So if you find an image on the site and you go, I want to use that one, you can look behind and say, what are the genes with a G that were used to make that image? And you can dial them up and dial them down, and then you can breed with other things. And people are making art with it. And part of the role of this site is to interrogate, issues like copyright and who gets credit for these things. Is it, the original? There's no one in the training data set who's going to get credit. Certainly the people who composite these things can claim credit, and people using them on album covers and all sorts of things. So I think it's a really playful space, and it's a great way to interrogate, generative imagery and what sort of, consequences and benefits that might have for various industries.
Oh my God. And so
I can't wait to talk about this. Yeah,
Dave, you sent us a few different links, and I just want to kind of bring something up is because the reason this really resonated with me, because on one of my Slack groups I was in, I'm going to pull this image up for everyone to look at. Basically, this image was posted saying, and if you're watching this on an enhanced podcast player, you'll see it there. It says, its picture is designed to give the viewer the simulated experience of having a stroke, particularly in the occipital lobe of the cerebral cortex where visual perception occurs. Everything looks hauntingly familiar, but you just can't recognize anything. And this image disturbed me so much. And everyone else that it is a cursed image. There's no kind of foreground or background or floor. You're completely
but
lost.
But it looks like a bench in a bathroom that with stuff on it that you could recognize, but as soon as you try to actually make sense of any of it, this hurts.
And one of my deepest fears along heights is having a stroke, and looking at this, I feel like I'm actually stroking out. And a lot of these images in the GANbreeder, which is based on another, it uses kind of a, it's similar to this other thing called PicBreeder, which is kind of a more kind of, primitive version of this, but this is so advanced and the images are just so disturbing just for their content alone. The actual implications of what this means for kind of art and copyright and design. There's so many different things we can kind of pick apart here. The resolution and the detail that is coming, and we've spoken about this when we've spoken about NVIDIA or kind of generative art and kind of, creating this whole industry itself. But yeah, I don't know. Laura, take it away. What do you got?
Oh, Dave, I thought this was such a fun link. And it's an interesting one because it's a very fun link, but it's got some very deep questions attached to it. So you can kind of we could keep it light or we can go deep. Obviously, we're going to go deep because that's what we do.
Take turns.
Yeah. I did want to mention Pick Breeder as well. If anyone listening hadn't sort of come across that, it was like a pretty, fairly similar, as you said, sort of more primitive version of this kind of network. It was released around 2007, I think. And one thing that I found really interesting was that, like, obviously Pick Breeder was like very eye-opening in its time. And it's interesting to note that something like GanBreeder, which is similar, developed, more developed, but similar, is still just as awe-inspiring 12 years later. It's like this stuff is still very novel to most people. And I just thought that was kind of interesting. One thing that was really unexpected for me when I was playing around with GanBreeder is that, and don't laugh at me, Jeremy, it genuinely...
You want to see what our baby would look like? I know.
Oh my God, I would never do that, you big creep. I did want to do that with Dan and I, but no, you can't upload your own images. Don't believe me, I thought about it. I was going to breed my dog with Jess's dog. It's like, oh yeah, believe me. But it really genuinely felt like one of the few times in my life that I was making art, that
very
I was
creative.
Like making something beautiful, you know? But like, but then I was thinking about it and it really fucked me up because I was like, but I'm not, am I? Like something else is making it for me and not in the complex, like kind of layered way that people sometimes gripe about like Photoshop or Illustrator doing the legwork for an artist, but like in a very clear, tangible way. Like I click some buttons, I use their preloaded images, and then I just sort of kept clicking, adjusting some levels, clicking again all over the course of like a minute or two. And some things that I felt were kind of truly beautiful came out. And it's just, it's bizarre. Like I wholly expected to see some weird stuff, but I wasn't prepared to feel like the outcomes were actually beautiful or artful or that I had some hand in it, which surprisingly, like even knowing kind of rationally that I didn't really make any of it, I had this kind of innate sense of ownership over the creation.
I've heard other people say that. I think
it was
think
a weird
it's
feeling.
Partly because the amount of sort of interface controls and options you get. So you actually feel like you're guiding the work rather than hitting a generate button.
Yes. I also think it's the terminology in terms of like breeding and genes and whatever. It does feel like a very personal thing that only you could have made because it's your genetics. And I, you know what I mean? I think it's something to do with the language as well. And I'll include some of the ones that I made in the show notes because it was fun. And you guys can tell me if you like them or not. God, Jeremy, your thoughts?
I don't have any kind of, you know, really kind of, I just have kind of reactions in terms of kind of how it makes me feel, which is weird. I mean, the images I feel kind of from that perspective are kind of confronting. At the same time, like, you know, you're still dealing with a very kind of specific kind of lens in terms of how it's kind of working.
Yes.
It's like, it's kind of like, it has this kind of shock effect at the beginning. And the more you look at it, the more you realize, okay, it's kind of doing like, I kind of see what it's doing and it's kind of creating this kind of one aesthetic. And obviously
it'll
be forced to kind of do something.
But then were
new.
You looking at like, cause if you browse through other people's stuff, because I was playing with it for a while and then there was like other people's stuff that I was like, how the hell did they get to that? I want to make something that looks like that. And I just could not figure out what to match up and what to get it to look like that. I kept generating like kind of similar stuff. No matter what I picked, it seemed like my clicks and what I was leaning towards just kept making quite similar things. And then other people were making these like totally different things. It was interesting.
Well, I think the big question is it's all about kind of input. And I kind of think in terms of, you know, this whole idea of a kind of originality, how it's important to kind of commercial work, how everyone's kind of influenced. I think it's like, you know, right now we're kind of the machines that are kind of generating the work. And obviously we are kind of influenced by the news and kind of everything we see and kind of our friends. And like, you know, well, how is that different to an actual kind of mechanical process or, you know, a less organic process and kind of what's happening here? It's like, well, right now we're just dealing with kind of the input of kind of these photos and, you know, anyone can put things in, but once you can start putting in more fluid and organic input, or when you could put in your own artwork as kind of input and kind of augment it in that way, I think, yeah, that's when we're going to kind of start to see some interesting kind of things coming up. Again, the question that I always have to ask is like, yeah, what is the kind of commercial application? Could this be used for kind of artists to actually kind of develop actual work? And I say, not yet, no, but very soon, and like probably sooner than we would all like, you know, because if these inputs can kind of come in this way that allows the outputs to be things that are a bit more recognizable and you're not feeling like you're having a stroke, for example, and the work can be kind of and you can kind of dial up actual kind of quality. It's like I want to dial up humor, dial up empathy, and kind of dial down different things. I think once we kind of start getting to that level, that's going to be when the rubber really hits the road.
Yeah, because I was thinking about that question as well, because Dave, you left some really good notes for us in terms of some things to think about, and that question of whether the artists we work with, whether we can see them kind of using this sort of interface to develop work. And I agree, honestly, sort of like no at this stage, but I say that because I think every artist that we currently work with and the work that we currently do trades almost entirely on originality, or at least perceived originality, for the sticklers on whether originality exists at all. You know, it's perceived, right? That's the important part. And there's definitely an inherent sense, or again, a perceived sense, at least, that involvement of this sort of interface ruins that someone, right? Especially if you've got commercial people, clients paying for it. They want something that took trouble to make by some person. And I think it's the same as with everything. When the tools are democratized so heavily that anyone can use them to create similar work, then there's no need to hire a specialist. And we deal very much in specialists, right? Like, that's what we trade on.
Isn't when that happens historically, don't artists and people with more expertise and experience find new edges? So when something becomes homogenous, like auto-tune, then artists sort of find new ways to express themselves and they move outside that.
Exactly. And I think that's why that kind of idea of originality, or only being able to be done by that person, or specializing, is kind of important still in the work that we do anyway. I don't mean it, not in general commercial art anyway, like necessarily across the board, but I do think it's not to say that someone wouldn't privately use this sort of thing for inspiration, which I wholeheartedly encourage. One thing that I loved about this was, yes, this idea that you kind of mentioned of, like, and kind of what you're, you know, doing with Move 37, this idea of where do the ideas come from, and kind of using that to kind of spur your human thinking, which is that augmenting that creativity, which I think is fascinating. And I think it's a really incredible way to put new thoughts together in a way that actually isn't totally possible using your human brain alone. Like, this is obviously a very limited lens through which to view this kind of whole topic, Ganbreeder, but there are things sort of going on in there when you play around with it that my human brain would not have, at least mine. Some people might think like this. I'm fucking worried for them.
One other interesting application for, say, illustrators who do this for a profession, and their work and the originality is very important to them. I think, imagine someone, you know, sketches a lot. They do a lot of drawings. They create a lot of stuff that hardly any of it sees the light of day. It's obviously their practice, their workflow. You could train the same neural network just on your work.
That's what I was thinking.
I think that's really interesting. And so you've got a private notebook that no one else uses, and it's helping you fulfill your ambitions based on your history of work. And, you know, Jeremy, in that analogy of the Apple Pencil, the pen's predicting what it thinks, you know, you might like to draw. You could turn it off, but, you know, breeding your own work kind of takes a lot of those issues out of it. So it's using the algorithmic and the data science stuff, but only for a personal piece of work.
I think that's so interesting as well. And the parallels between, like, I mean, you think about, like, 18th century artists having teams of underlings who would create their paintings for them. Yeah. Yep, exactly. Not just in the 18th century. Or even like Warhol, you know, and like Warhol, trading on that whole idea. And I think, like, it's interesting to see the parallels between that and whether we actually draw any, like, negative difference between this. I don't know. But one project that I saw when I was reading about this stuff, and I thought it was really interesting. There's this artist, Alex Reben, and he took Ganbreeder and Google's Big GAN that it's based on, and he used this crazy 7-step process to generate works. And I just want to quickly read the steps to you guys. Okay, so step one, an AI combines different words together to generate an image of what it thinks those words look like. Step two, the AI then produces variants of those images by breeding it with other images, creating child images. So these two steps are basically Ganbreeder. And then it branches out from here. Step three, another AI shows the artist several of the child images, measuring his brain waves and body signals to select which image he likes best. Step four, they repeat step two and three until the AI determines that it's reached an optimal image. Step five, another AI increases the resolution of the image by filling in the blanks with what it thinks should exist there. And step six, the result is sent to be painted on canvas by anonymous painters in a Chinese painting village. Step seven, a final AI looks at the image, tries to figure out what's in it, and makes a title for it. And so, like, there's no, I guess, necessarily real application for this yet, I guess, but I just thought it was very interesting. We'll post a link to the work so you guys can look at them.
Yeah. I think, Dave, your point before is kind of a great kind of summary that I think I always kind of say that artists, you know, ignore tech at their own peril. And I kind of think it's an amazing kind of tool to really expand your palette. And I know, like, when I was doing lettering and kind of learning how to do it in school, like, you'd actually do it kind of upside down and give you a better kind of sense of the perspective. And I kind of think so many of the times I hear now, it's like, you know, artists are kind of limited by their imaginations in terms of, yeah, trying to find kind of new ways to express themselves. So it's like, yeah, why not kind of get into this and see kind of what comes out of it? Because, yeah, I mean, why not? It's great. Thank you so much for bringing this to us. I'm just curious, what newsletter did you find this from? Was this from a newsletter or from Twitter?
This is probably a lot of the creative AI, more websites. And yeah, this one's been going around for a while. And the one that preceded this, Pick to Pick, which is probably based on Pick Demo.
Pick Breeder, or whatever it's called.
Yeah, the one that preceded this, Pick-to-Pick, I think it was Braced on Pick Breeder, allows you to sketch an outline and then composite an animal or a house or a shoe in that.
Yes, that's right.
Which is fascinating stuff.
Yes, I remember playing with that in the office here when that came up. Yeah.
So there's some really good resources for people who are generating art. Google funds a bunch of artists privately to work on experiments like this. Google's a big kind of sponsor of experimental creative AI art. Mm. So those kind of resources are where this
thing
comes
up. They've got that website that's like experiments.withgoogle.com and then so they've got like an AI collection.
Yeah, they're not all AI, but there's a guy.
Yeah, they've got three or four. Actually, they've got more. No, they've got like maybe like 10 AI experiments on there that are specific to AI, which are quite interesting.
Yeah, one of the guys who ended up sort of going to work for Google Brain, his name's Ross Goodwin, and his stuff's worth looking up. And we had him out when we kind of announced Move 37 a couple of years ago at Vivid in Sydney. Mm. We put on an event at the Museum of Contemporary Art, and he spoke and blew people's minds. And basically his shtick, which is well played out now, but is he'd made this thing called Word Camera, and you hold up an image that generates poetry. And then he called himself the first gonzo technologist because he created a thing called Word Car and hooked up a car and drove across America, and basically it created poetry on what it saw because it had a camera looking at the car. So it's like, you know, beatnik kind of on the road.
Jack Kerouac stuff. I love that idea.
So I think none of those ideas might be original, but I think the combinatorial aspect of art and design is still, you know, has capacity for originality, even though when you sort of dissect it, there might not be, you know.
Yeah, I think either way, like everything that we've looked at today kind of does point to the fact that we are moving into a really interesting period of augmented creativity and this kind of combination between sort of computer power and human power. And I, for one, am excited to see where it takes us.
Thank you so much for bringing this to the table, Dave. Really appreciate it. Awesome stuff. Before we wrap up for the week, it is time for our favorite segment, Thumbs Up, Thumbs Down, Shaka, the time we dedicate each week to get the good, the bad, and the completely exalted off of our chest.
Oh, you're going fancy today, Jeremy.
Going fancy. Laura, what do you got for us this week?
Okay, I got a thumbs up this week to a podcast I've recently rekindled my love for. Sorry to talk about another podcast. This is blasphemy. And I got caught up in new shows and kind of forgot about it. And now that I'm back, I'm remembering why I loved it so damn much in the first place. So the podcast is called Flash Forward, and it's a podcast about the future. Every episode, they take on a possible or sometimes completely ridiculous but interesting kind of future scenario. So everything from like California becoming an independent republic to teleportation to universal basic income to things like humans, animals being able to communicate with one another. And they break it down first. They always start with this kind of fictional scene that's played out by voice actors just to set the scene, which is really fun. And then they come back to real life and they bring on all sorts of experts from all sides of the topic to flesh out the realities of that potential reality. And it's just everything I want in a podcast. Like the host, Rose Eveleth, she's also the creator, the producer, and editor. She's fabulous. She's got the career I dream of. And the research is really deep. It's educational, but it's also really amusing to listen to and kind of expands your brain in a really fun way. And they take every topic seriously, no matter how nuts or kind of terrible it is. For example, I was listening to the teleportation one this morning, and it was just like fascinating to consider how it would actually genuinely affect everything from the economy to our physical environment to politics, family bonds, work cultures, etc. And it's just so good. Flash Forward, go have a listen after you're done with this though.
Dave, what about yourself?
Mine was a small thing, which I'm sure you guys have seen by now, but it made me laugh out loud, was a reminder that humans are fallible regardless of your production budget when the Starbucks cup ended up in the episode of Game of Thrones.
My favorite.
And yes, go on.
And I thought that made me smile, made me laugh. It made me think it doesn't matter how much preparation. Does proper preparation really prevent piss poor performance? That's what my footy coach used to say. Apparently not always. So I love that.
This also brought up an image of a water bottle in a Downton Abbey shoot as well, which is a phenomenal B-side to that. Mine for the week is a bit of a inspiration from Laura's actually, which is a book that was my favorite book in 1989 called Future Stuff. You can still buy it used on Amazon. And it's one of these books that predicted all these different things that were going to happen. I think stuff that would be in the future, like toys that you can buy. One of them was a real life, it was an oversized amusement park ride where you'd be able to kind of be a pinball. It was a pinball machine, oversized pinball machine where you were the pinball. And I'm waiting for it to happen. It hasn't happened yet. They also gave like little indications of how likely it was to happen. But Dave, I think you would really love this book. And yeah, hearing Laura's link just kind of made me hearken back to it in a way. So yeah, we'll put all those links as we do.
I want to say very quickly, HBO put out like a little statement that just said like the latte that appeared in the episode was a mistake. Daenerys had ordered a herbal tea, which I thought was nice. Good.
I can't believe it made it in. Amazing.
Well, did you see that the showrunners who would normally be in charge of this stuff were actually extras in that scene? So they weren't there doing that job, and that's why it was like so good.
So they didn't just have one job. They actually had two jobs.
Yeah, they had two jobs.
Dave, if people want to find out more about either you, your thoughts on AI, or Move 37 in general, where can they do that on the internet?
They could follow me on Twitter at Dave King, but that might include sort of posts about North Melbourne and my partner's book and all sorts of other things. But we have a website, move37.ai. Our first product is called Gene, and that's available at getgene.com, J-E-A-N. And in general, I think, you know, for the creative stuff, creative AI stuff, follow some people on Twitter and you know, find out who's working with the different models in for Google or Facebook and doing creative things.
Amazing. Thank you so much for your time for coming down today.
It's been awesome. Thank you, Dave.
Thanks, guys.
I'm Jeremy Wartzman, she's Lara Tenbaker, and this has been Jackie Winter Gives You the Business. Our theme music is by totally unrelated to our company, Melbourne-based musician Jackie Winter. You can check out his stuff on soundcloud.com/Jackie Winter. If you want more of JWGYTV, archives of all of our shows and links we cover can be found at jackiewinter.givesyouthe.biz. And to receive all of the links we talk about on the show each week in one neat little package, you can sign up to our newsletter at jwg.is/newslettering. Again, jwg.is/newslettering. You can also find us mostly on Instagram at Jackie Winter. That's Jackie with a Y, Winter like the season, and it is up with any recommendations, feedback, or questions at podcast@jackiewinter.com. Remember, this is an enhanced podcast. If you listen to this using Pocket Cast, Overcast, or Castro, you'll be able to see the links to the articles as we're talking about them, as well as other visual content as we go on. And if you work for an editing agency or design studio and are interested in our live extended version of the show called Open Tabs, be sure to check out opentabs.rodeo for more info. Thanks for listening. Catch you next week. Bye. Bye.
It might be easier having it on the side of your laptop because I'm just thinking if we need to get this kind of to your mouth.
How's that?
Let's see.
How's that? Is that any good?
Let's see.
Do I sound intelligent? Can we cut that? Can we start again?
That's going straight to the blooper reel.
You're a natural already.